Then he pointed a finger at me like a gun. No, not a symphony, a mass, a vast choral work, epic in its scope, studiedly archaic in structure, consecutive fifths and false relations vis a brooding sanctus, a threnody for lost innocence, an anthem to the crime and the glory of Schuyler Hausmann. There isn't any glory, Quirrenbach, only crime. I won't know until you tell me the rest, will I? There was a series of thumps and shudders as the behemoth was unplugged from its connecting point on the habitat. Through the windows I could see the habitat falling away very quickly, accompanied by a moment of dizziness. But almost before the moment had begun to register physically, the habitat came swooping past again, its skin rushing by the great windows. Then only space. I looked around, but people were still walking unaffected around the lobby. Shouldn't we be in freefall? Not in a behemoth, Quirrenbach said. The instant she detached from envy, she fell away on a tangent to the habitat's surface, like a slingshot. But that only lasted for an instant before she ramped up her thrusters to 1G. Then she had to curve slightly to avoid ramming into the habitat on the way past. That's the only really tricky part of the journey, I understand. The only time where there's really any likelihood of your drinks going for a ride. But the pilot seemed to know what it was doing. It? They use genetically engineered cetaceans to fly these things, I think. Whales or porpoises, wired permanently into the behemoth's nervous system. But don't worry. They've never killed anyone. It'll feel as smooth as this most of the way down. She just lowers herself down into the atmosphere, very gently and slowly. A behemoth's like a huge, rigid airship once it gets into any kind of air density. By the time she gets near the surface, she's got so much positive buoyancy that she actually has to use her thrusters to hold herself down. It's a lot like swimming, I think. Quirrenbach clicked his fingers at a servitor which was passing. Drinks, I think. What can I offer you, Tanner? I looked out the window. Yellowstone's horizon was rising vertically, so that the planet looked like a sheer yellow wall. I don't know. What do they drink around here? Yellowstone's horizon tilted slowly back towards horizontal as the behemoth cancelled out the orbital velocity it had matched with the carousel. The process was smooth and uneventful, but it must have been planned meticulously so that when we finally came to a halt relative to the planet, we were hovering precisely over Chasm City rather than thousands of kilometers away. By then, although we were thousands of kilometers above the surface, Yellowstone's gravity was still almost as strong as it would have been on the ground. We might as well have been sitting atop a very tall mountain, one that protruded beyond the atmosphere. Slowly, however, with the unhurried calm which had characterized the whole journey so far, the behemoth began to descend. Quirrenbach and I watched the view in silence. Yellowstone was a heavier sibling to Sol's Titan, a fully-fledged world rather than a moon. Chaotic and poisonous chemistries of nitrogen, methane, and ammonia produced an atmosphere daubed with every imaginable shade of yellow. Ochre, orange, tan, walled into beautiful cyclonic spirals, curlicued and filigreed as if by the most delicate brushwork. Over most of its surface, Yellowstone was exquisitely cold, lashed by ferocious winds, flash floods, and electrical storms. The planet's orbit around Epsilon Eridani had been disturbed in the distant past by a close encounter with Tangerine Dream, the system's massive gas giant, and even though that event must have taken place hundreds of millions of years